The K-Pop Podcast is sponsored by T. Rowe Price. Are you looking to learn a thing or two about getting your finances in order, saving, and investing? Check out The Confident Wallet, a personal finance podcast series by T. Rowe Price and the Washington Post Brand Studio. Coming soon to wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Jonathan Capehart and welcome to Cape Up. President Trump delivers his first State of the Union address, but lifelong Republican and former party chair Michael Steele says after 1 year of the Trump presidency, the State of the Union is shaky. And the former Catholic seminarian, y'all knew that, right? Well, he has words for evangelical Christians who turned a blind eye to Trump's moral failings. In his third visit to the podcast, Michael Steele doesn't hold back. Michael Steele, welcome back. This is your third time.
It's so great to be here with you for the third time.
The third time. And there's no one better to talk to because the president's going to be talking about the State of the Union,
right. The
state of our union. And there's no better way to start this conversation than with something you said recently on Hardball. Listen.
I have very simple admonition at this point. Just shut the hell up and don't ever preach to me about anything ever again. I don't want to hear it because after telling me how to live my life, who to love, what to believe, what not to believe, what to do and what not to do, and now you sit back and if the prostitutes don't matter,
yeah.
The grabbing the you know what doesn't matter, the outright behavior and lies don't matter. To shut up.
But if you're a baker, you do not have to bake a cake for a gay wedding.
Yeah.
That's one of your rights. Anyway.
They have no voice.
So that person who was saying there, it was our friend Chris Matthews,
yeah.
Another friend of the podcast, yep. Alum of the podcast. But this, what you had to say was in reaction to this latest nuttiness from so-called evangelical Christians.
Right.
Reacting to the news about Stormy Daniels and the reported money paid to her to keep her quiet about the alleged affair she had with then private citizen Donald Trump. And everyone's giving him a pass. One said, let's give him a mulligan. Another one said something else. What does this say about the evangelical movement? What does it say about the Republican Party overall?
It says, let's start with the movement, such as it is. It says that it has become no better. And this point was actually made by Susan Page on Hardball that evening. It's become no different than any other lobbying group in town. It is in the business of getting something. And what they are willing to trade off for the something they want, whether Supreme Court justice or tax cut or whatever, is their, in my view, their soul, their moral underpinning, the character of who they are. Remember, we're talking about individuals, and in this case, represented by leaders, because I don't want this to be all evangelicals, because I've gotten a lot of response from evangelicals around the country who said, thank you, because we are tired of our leadership, putting us out this way and putting us in a position where they're mixing politics and faith together. But it is the leadership specifically that is drawing this conversation in the direction that it's going. And the fact of the matter is, when you have spent the better part of, 30 years telling the American people, as I said, how to behave, what to think, who to love, who not to love, what to do, what not to do, you're wrong, condemn you, judge you. And now you're going to come back because this man, the president, has given you a tax cut or Supreme Court justice that you like. So I want, Tony Perkins and others to give a mulligan to all those people that they condemned over the last 30 years. Where's their mulligan? And if you're going to be in the business of making these kinds of judgments, because I think the last place you need to be is in a place of judgment because the Lord said, thou shalt not judge. That's not our role. That's not our role. But if you want to go there, then check your hypocrisy. Because for me, it's about being true to the Gospels and certainly being true to yourself and decouple the politics. It was a concern I had, Jonathan, going back from the very early days of my involvement in politics, as I watched the then moral majority, get embraced and encapsulated within the political structure, becoming an arm of the Republican Party. And that has led over that arc of time to where we are now. The party did not used to be like that. It wasn't anti-religion by no means. Mm-hmm. But what it recognized in a very libertarian way was that that was a value set that you yourself could define. I didn't get to define that. No government absolutely would define that. And no political party should define that. But here we are in which you have certain individuals who cast aspersions on Muslims because they're not Christian. Well, that's not very Christian, okay? Who cast aspersions on other faith traditions because of their politics. And that, to me, is not a good space to be in. And so with respect to the state of our union in that regard, it is not healthy. It is not healthy. We find ourselves to be much more judgmental. We find ourselves to be much more critical about others and their lifestyles. I believe, as a Christian, as a Catholic Christian, that those are choices you get to make and decisions you make in your own life. I'm not going to be standing next to you at the pearly gate. That's between you and your maker. That's a one-on-one deal. You don't get to bring your friends to vouch for you. Okay? So that's one-on-one. So I don't get to be in that space. So you have to be comfortable with looking the Lord Almighty in the eye and going, yeah, I condemn them, particularly given that he came here and condemned no one.
What has driven me crazy about this last year,
mm-hmm.
And certainly through the presidential campaign, is watching all of these people who have been doing the condemning, who have mm-hmm. been doing the lecturing, who have right. been who have been telling me and whichever part of me you think I'm talking about, that part of me is wrong or less than,
right.
to see them bend over backwards to give this guy all kinds of breaks. I mean, I sit there and thinking, I grew up in the time when Reagan was president and George H.W. Bush were president, mm-hmm. when they, mm-hmm. those two men were president. That's the first half of my life.
Right.
Everything that I know about the Republican Party, about reverence for the Constitution, about reverence for the presidency, about morals and mm-hmm. who we are as a mm-hmm. country, I learned as a result of Republicans being in charge.
Right.
And now these same people are now like just ripped everything up. Like, yeah. I don't even know what to think anymore. And I don't... that's just me just right. unburdening myself because it is galling.
It is galling, and it is an unfair burden for you to have to bear as a black man, as a gay man, as an American. Whatever label you give yourself, whatever way you live your life, it is not for me. It is not certainly for some damn political party. Are you freaking kidding me? Sitting in judgment of the choices I make, the decisions I make, that's something that, you know, I move into communities where, you know, I have a role to play and I can, you know, go out and I can express myself and, you know, that's how that plays itself out. But you don't get to come back around and tell me that my choices, my decisions, my life and all of that doesn't matter. Or in order for it to matter, you have to live it a certain way or be a certain way. And so you're absolutely right. From my perspective, watching that timeline unfold and to watch this transformation from what Herbert Walker Bush described as compassionate conservatism to become hateful, spiteful, judgmental conservatism is not what the party has ever been about. And I think, you know, we need to figure out how to unburden ourselves of that because it is certainly not the party of Lincoln. And it's not something that any of the men and women who helped really build and grow this party would ever ascribe to.
You know, people should remember, those who didn't listen to the first of your podcast interviews, which was the first Cape Up.
Yeah.
We got into talking about the fact that you were in seminary.
Yeah.
Like, religion for you is not a hobby. It's not something that, you know, I can rattle off scriptures because, you know, I do that on the side. No, you were studying. Yeah. You were in the priesthood.
Yeah, I was studying for the priesthood. I wore the habit of the Augustinian order for a short time as a seminarian. So when I looked into the camera and I looked at Chris and those on that panel and said what I said, that came from a place of conviction. That came from a place of recognition of what it was I was hearing from those men of the cloth, those men who perpetuate this idea of evangelicalism that I found to be inconsistent with the evangelical men and women that I know, many of whom are members of my family. And even though I'm Catholic, we've got, you know, the Baptists and Church of God in Christ. I mean, we've got a beautiful cross section of folks, evangelical types in the family. So
what I want to know is if you're the Catholic and then you've got the Baptist and the, what was the other one?
Church of God in Christ.
That,
yeah.
So that means you're the tamest, the calmest.
Yeah.
Of the bunch. Yeah. I just want that to let that just settle in for people.
I'm the quiet one. I'm the quiet one, just so people know. You come to our house at Thanksgiving, you're going to raise up some ugly religion stuff. You're going to get beat down pretty bad. You know, you don't want my mama in that conversation, or my Aunt Mary. No, Lord, she's the Church of God in Christ. So, she's no.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt your flow, but I was just fascinated by that.
Yeah, it does come from a place that is born out of a certain experience and understanding, listening and learning, and being taught as a young man in the seminary how you value these things. And one of the first lessons you learn is dying to self, so it's not about you. And the second is how you lift up and how you embrace and how you welcome. And I know that's not part of our politics today, which is why I think the state of our union is, in some sense, on a very personal level, shaky. Yes, the Dow Jones is 26,000 and roaring. Okay, great. And, you know, people are getting jobs and things are moving around and money's flowing from overseas and all that. But what's the soul of the country like? What are we like as Americans? What are we, when I look at you and you look at me, what do you see? What do you feel? If I saw you fall on crossing a street, would I stop and, you know, help you, or would I walk past you? And if I knew you were a Democrat, would I stop and help you? That's what we've come to. I'd otherwise stop and help you, but if I knew you were if I knew you were Republican, no. So the infection of the American soul by our politics, to me, I think has been the most damaging thing that's happened over the last 2 years.
What role does the president play in that, in the answer to your question, what's the soul of the country like?
You know, that I don't want to give him an outsized, or any president, an outsized role to play there. But they do have a role. We have historically, from the very founding of the country, looked at the president as not just a military leader, not just a political leader, but a moral leader. You know, probably certainly a lot less today than there was back in the day, so to speak. Our leaders were not afraid to express openly their faith and belief in God, their, church-going habits, all that stuff. And that's fine. I mean, I get that, you know, a lot of people, for as the country has grown and evolved and welcomed people of all kinds of traditions, that we're much more respectful and it's not down your throat kind of deal. But that still doesn't mean that the leader of the free world, President of the United States, has an obligation to project us, all right? And to project us in a way that best reflects the very values on which the country was founded. So we were founded on ideals and principles that talked about welcoming people from foreign shores to this shore. We were founded on principles about freedom and opportunity, and so forth and so on. So I think those values still matter. And even in these days, Jonathan, the idea that my faith tenets and teachings can be a part of helping me shape policy and helping me shape the character of the things that I'm involved in, that's not bad. The absence of that, the rejection of that, is where I think we run into a problem. We've never struggled in this vein before until now, and that's what bothered me so much about what I heard, Franklin Graham and others say to excuse behavior that you know, on Sunday morning they're going to stand in a pulpit and condemn.
Right.
You know they are. They're not going to condone adultery. They're not going to condone misogynist behavior towards women. They're not going to condone views on race that even if you want to be Gentile about it and not call it racist, certainly emboldens racism. All right? They're not going to be tolerant of that. And yet here they are, and I think as a country, we should be concerned. What bothers me even further is the lack of concern.
Yeah,
people seem to have. I was like, oh, okay, whatever.
No, that's just him.
That's just him. I'm like, okay.
No, and I'm glad you brought up morality and race, because where the moment I said, I cannot respect this person as president of the United States,
right,
was that Tuesday press conference in August when President Trump said that there were fine people on both sides.
Yeah.
I thought he squandered the moral authority that office. Not squandered, he stripped that office of its moral authority. Yeah. And for me, that was, of all the things that he has done, that he would do that and thereby unleash and give credence to the racial demons.
Right.
That we have worked so hard to at least keep at bay.
Right.
But the fact that the president of the United States is the one who's got the bullhorn in his hand and is riling them up, revving them up, was just something that I couldn't countenance. And I don't know, to your point about the soul of the country, can we get it back when the president of the United States feels compelled to do what he did with Charlottesville, to do what he's done depending on the day, depending on the hour, depending on who talked to him last, on immigration.
Right.
This is the guy who started his campaign by saying Mexicans are rapists.
Right, right. And but finds himself now, you know, saying, oh, well, I'll give the children of those Mexicans a pathway to citizenship. So there is sort of this conflicting nature within Donald Trump, and I've come to appreciate that about him on many levels, and I think that when you know going back and looking at that moment, which was a very important moment for a lot of reasons, some of which you've touched on, I think it also was one in which the president was not so much working out of a space of racism, like he was being a racist in that moment. I think what he was doing, I'm not saying that he isn't, or that, you know, you got this look on your face.
Yeah, I'm waiting. Well,
no. But
waiting for the landing.
No.
Spot.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is, I think for him, a whole bunch of things came together at one time. All right, and they all kind of converged. The political nod to part of his base. I don't want to put myself in a position where I'm condemning one side or not condemning the other side. You know, I think all this came out, and this is really making your point that when you do not show the fortitude in a moment like that to stand on conviction, to stand on principle, then you do fall into the various traps that await you. And that inner thing in you comes out. And that's why a lot of people looked at that moment and go, well, that was just racist.
Yeah. And you know, to Michelle Obama's point, the job of president doesn't change you. It shows you who you are.
It shows us who you are.
Yeah.
And see, I don't think in Trump's case, this job is showing him who he is. Because he already has defined in his own head and mind who he is. So as much as the pressures and the aspects of the job that kind of press in on a president sort of reshapes them And we've seen that. We've seen that. We've seen how certain presidents who did not have a very strong faith tradition wind up going to church every Sunday. You know, we've seen how this job kind of moves them through that particular funnel. Donald Trump is impervious to it. And that's because for him, he is agnostic on all the things that anchor most men and hopefully women one day in that job in a way that allows them to do the job with the level of sensitivity and understanding that would lead them to know, recognize in a Charlottesville moment, there are no two sides.
Right.
There's only one side. Right. And it's the side that says, sir, you are racist. You are wrong. This is not America. This is not who we are. And we will not tolerate it. We will not support it. We will not give it credence. And that, to your point, was a moment missed. And it was missed because the president hasn't grown into that aspect of the job.
Well, you know, I was going to ask, why don't you think he has reverence for the job?
Because I think he just sees it as a job. I think he sees it as a job, and I think he sees it as a job he doesn't like.
I was going to say, or a job he doesn't want.
Yeah, jobs he doesn't like or doesn't want.
Do you think the American people, well, let me recast the question. Should the American people trust the president? Should they trust President Trump?
I think, yeah. My hope is I would like to see the American people trust the president, trust the institutions like the FBI and all the other things, institutions that have come under fire, because that's foundational to who we are. But let me be clear.
Yeah, because I wasn't going down that route. I'm talking about him in a different route.
But they're linked. They actually are linked. And it's all part of a bigger thing. Because what's happening now can and likely will have an impact on the next president and the president after that one. How we look at that person. Just think about what happened in the short span between Nixon and Reagan and how the American people began to feel about the American presidency and the president as a result of Watergate. Then you got to Jimmy Carter and the whole malaise. You know, by the, it's just like, you know what? These guys, they can't get it right. They're criminals, they're crooks, they're whatever. And then Reagan came in with this, and people refer to it as this imperial presidency. But it wasn't about him being imperial and wanting all. It was about restoring that very nature and character of the presidency that we once trusted. And we saw him do that. We saw him elevate the presidency in a way that moved the American people towards respecting it and trusting it. That's how, in many respects, to be honest, that's what helped Bill Clinton in some respects when he went through his stuff. Now, it tore at the edges, for sure. But that a Bill Clinton in this environment today would, the question is, would he even be impeached at this point? Would be a whole. I think the American people just kind of be dismissive of him and the office, very much as we see them being dismissive of this president and the office. And that concerns me. That really concerns me because it is one of the three institutions that four, if you include the fourth estate, mm-hmm. the media. That grounds the value system that we define as America.
Well, you know, one of the things about the Watergate era that we don't have now is that we had a robust legislative branch.
True.
A legislative branch that was strong enough and secure enough where a Republican member of Congress could right. go to the White House and say to the Republican president, right. Mr. President, if you do not resign, you will be impeached. And someone asked me the other day, who do you think will be the Republican to go, if the time comes, will go to the White House and tell President Trump that the time is up, he has to resign? And I said, I don't think there's anybody. No one has the stature to do that, one. And two, what makes anybody think that President Trump would even listen to that person? That requires somebody to have, to your point, a core conviction, a right. reverence for the office, a reverence for the Constitution, a right. reverence for the country that is, personally speaking, lacking in the current occupant. So where's Congress?
Agreed on that. Agreed on the underlying issue question. The Congress is landlocked, as I like to call it, cemented. Its feet are cemented by the poll numbers in their respective states and congressional districts that show the popularity of the president.
That's the
bottom line.
That's
so you will not see anyone begin to chisel away at that block of cement around their feet until those numbers show that President Trump has lost popularity in their respective congressional districts or their state.
Is that even going to I don't foresee a day where that will happen.
No, it actually is happening.
It is happening.
If polls are showing that the president, to put it in generic terms, is wearing thin for a lot of people. And that's why there's been so much more hype by the administration and certain members of Congress on one of several fronts. One is the tax cuts. You know, oh my God, now you're going to get all this money. Well, you're going to, on average, get about $20 a paycheck, if that.
And not to knock it. I mean, $20 is $20, but I mean, they make it sound like you've won a lottery ticket every paycheck.
Exactly. So there is that. But the other is what you see happening with the Mueller investigation and the reinforcement of this negative anti-institution narrative that surprises me still that Republicans are engaging in it to the degree that they have and are, because these are the very same men and women who lifted up Robert Mueller, lifted up James Comey, lifted up a number of the individuals who've since come under fire as workaday heroes. These were the men and women who, you know, the ultimate in law enforcement. And now they're getting all up into FISA hearings. You know, they're acting like they're violations of the constitutional rights. I had Congressman Gohmert on my...
on your radio show, SiriusXM.
Right. And I asked him, I said, so if things are as bad as you're saying they are, why hasn't the Congress changed the law? If all these violations have been going on by the FBI and other bodies, you wrote the law.
Right.
You have oversight. Where's the oversight? And needless to say, the answer was...
Yeah. They don't want to do that part of the job.
No, they don't.
They're more like staff.
Yeah.
To the executive.
Yeah, yeah. In this, and have become increasingly so... over the last 15 or so years. Mm-hmm. And you can see the breakdown in that relationship going back really to 9/11, mm-hmm. where the executive branch asserted itself at a time of national crisis, which we expect a, quote, commander-in-chief to do.
Right.
But what was lost and forgotten in translation was the constitutional requirement, which is why I've always emphasized from the very beginning that the president needed to go into the well of the United States Congress and make his declaration to the people of this country through its elected representatives. And that those representatives would then, at that time, either support or not support the president's declaration. That's how it's supposed to work constitutionally. You don't just get to wake up in the morning and go, oh, we're just going to call everybody an enemy combatant and go to war. That's not how it's supposed to work. That's why this whole Iraq war, Vietnam war, and all the, no, because they weren't the only, the last war we had was World War II, when Roosevelt went into the well and committed himself to his constitutional obligation to lay it out before the American people through their elected representatives, and they voted on it. And that's how this should work, because what it does is, in my view, it reinforces the president's hammer as commander-in-chief to then commit our men and women in uniform service to a military action. It, two, rallies the American people behind that action. And three, the Congress then has, I'll use the term, the cover, to then make the types of appropriations necessary without all the back and forth that we've seen over the last 15, 20 years. Every time, you know, it's time to write a bill and you got people arguing, well, we need to take care of our troops because we're at war. And we, you know, all that stuff goes away. But that's not the space we're in. And that's why you need a strong congressional and senatorial partner working with the executive.
Okay, so what should happen if President Trump were to indeed succeed in firing Bob Mueller? What should happen?
I think, well, what should happen, what will happen, they should be the same thing, but probably, you know, this question is they would be. First, I think it would create an immediate constitutional crisis. I really do. I think it will push and put a lot of Republicans back on their heels. They then will have to make a decision. They will have to make a decision. What is the next thing that comes out of your mouth when that happens? Because the next thing that comes out of your mouth when that happens is probably the most important thing you will ever have said in the job of Congress as a congressman, woman, or a senator, period. So I don't know. Right now, my thought would be if recent narratives that have been unfolding about the president actually wanting to fire and actually commanding the firing of the special counsel, having that blocked and pushed back by the White House counsel, that says to me a lot about what members of Congress need to be on point about. You need to stand with the White House counsel. So if for some reason that system breaks out internally at the White House, then the backup has got to be the Congress, has got to be the Senate.
Do you think the reason why we're hearing about this story, first leaked, reported by the New York Times, and then quickly confirmed by the Washington Post and NBC News and all sorts of other organizations that this was...
And more importantly, Fox News.
And Fox News in real time on Hannity's show,
yeah,
that there was major concern that this was going to come up again, and that they needed to put this news out there as a warning, since the president watches the news,
right,
to say, we see that now everybody knows what you've been up to.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that. I think there was a lot of sort of flagging this that moment in June to push back on the president, because I do believe that internally, the president wants desperately to move in that direction of firing the special counsel. His problem is manifold. One, the inside resistance from his own counsel and others, advisors. And two, I think it's going to be who will do it.
All right. I have two questions before I let you go.
Time to go already.
Yeah, I know. Right. Okay, so, Michael, why shouldn't we blame you for the current condition that we're in? And I say that because when you were chairman of the RNC,
I did my job.
You were the man who ushered in Republican rule, the Tea Party Revolution,
hey,
took over Congress,
the House
in the 2010.
That's right, baby. I built that bad out of steel.
Yeah.
Now, done that, I can't help it if they went inside and started tearing up the floorboards and knocking out the windows and crapping all over the house. I can't. That's not me. It's like, okay, I built it, and I got y'all a place to be, and now this is how you're going to treat it? That's not on me. Having said that, what's important to note, I think, is, and it is frustrating, particularly when I look at the tax bill, because the men and women that I ran around the country with for, 18 months, helping to get positioned, make the case to the American people, make the argument for why Republican leadership and Republican, not control of government, but governance was important as an important check on Obama, and B, to show that we had the capacity to govern. Why that was important and making that case was because it resonated for me at the time, and I love the contrast between where President Obama was going and where I thought Republican philosophies and ideas around certain policies would also rest. All right. So I'm naive that way. I'm thinking this will be a great little battle. Now, what was interesting was a lot of those folks were part of Tea Party and the like. They were very much about the constitutional principle that, you know, government should be limited. Government should not spend more than it takes in. We should not grow the national debt. We should not create deficits.
That's what it was.
This is what it was.
And now look where we are.
I don't know what the hell happened, because as I sat there and watched them vote for a $1.5 trillion debt increase, a number that's going to be placed on the backs of every young person born today, will have to account for that $1.5 trillion during the course of their lifetime, plus whatever else is there, the other $20 trillion that's there. I didn't understand that. It made no sense because it was inconsistent, and it has been inconsistent with what we said we wanted to do, how we would govern, that we wanted to manage the nations. We watched President Obama for a whole host of reasons, some good, some not so good, watch the national debt grow under his term. We got pissed as conservatives, fiscal hawks and Republicans, during the Bush years, watching the national debt grow from what was then several hundred billion dollars to close to $10 trillion dollars. So we rebelled against that, and yet we watched them just embrace it and create debts. I don't know. So don't blame me. I'm seeing a psychotherapist as well. I'm trying to figure it out. So, you know.
And then finally, Chairman Steele, former chair of the Republican Party, given everything that you've just said, why are you still a Republican?
Because of what I just said. Because of the last thing I just said in terms of those things, those values that I still hold true to. I think they're worth fighting for. I'm not ready to cede the party that I've now been a member of for 40 years. 40 years of my life I've been a member of this party. And I'm not ready to cede that ground, because I think about the 17-year-old kid who took the risk, went against the odds, went against the grain growing up here in Washington, D.C., that was, you know, very much, why would you do that? My own mother asked me that question. Just like, what is your problem? But I saw something that made sense to me. And I watched and learned and listened and understood that, you know, the Republican Party is the political home for the African-American community. It was. And I still believe it should be. And so part of my goal, my ideal, I guess, is to get that back. I tried it as chairman. I tried it when I was a county chairman. I was a state chairman, as national chairman, and had fairly, you know, degrees of successes along the way in doing that. But what I see now, where I have a president who acknowledges the racism on the other side is okay, who refers to the homeland that my family came from as a shithole, I know that's not my party. I know that's not conservatism. I know that's not Republicanism. And so that for me engages up for me the fight. I just think it's worth the fight to prove that that's not who we are. And I wish, to be honest with you, Jonathan, I wish more in my party would do that. I don't know what they're afraid of. As I would say to my evangelical friends, you can support the president's policies and still condemn his behavior.
Michael Steele, former chair of the Republican National Committee, host of Steele and Unger on Sirius XM Radio. Thank you very much for coming back,
Jonathan.
A third time.
A third time. I'm going to get a little plaque on the wall and put up in here and then put my face there and my name. Okay, maybe not.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
If you like Cape Up, you should check out some of our other great podcasts. Like Can He Do That? With Allison Michaels, a podcast that explores the powers and limitations of the American presidency. Or try Constitutional, a series about how people have framed and reframed the Constitution over time from host Lillian Cunningham. You can find these shows anywhere you listen to podcasts and learn more online at washingtonpost.com/podcasts.
The Washington
Post.